illegal occupation of Palestinian territory and its commission of war crimes and crimes against humanity against the Palestinian people. Opponents of the Zionist regime's crimes should register their strong opposition to the U.S. enabling of the Zionist regime's oppression of Palestinians, both to their Congress members and the White House. As long as the U.S. regime receives no significant pushback, it will continue to facilitate the Zionist regime's illegal occupation and violate the human rights of the Palestinian people. People can also join the boycotts, divestment, sanctions movement to end international support for the Zionist regime's oppression of Palestinians and pressure the fabricated regime of Israel to comply with international law. According to Middle East Monitor, almost 200 Palestinian and international organizations representing civil society have called on the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, ICC, Karim Khan, to investigate the allegations of war crimes committed by the Zionist regime against Palestinians. Wafa has reported. The resident of the Assembly of States Parties to International Criminal Court, Silvia Fernandez do Gurmendi, was included in the memorandum submitted to the court. The signatories called for public condemnation of the Zionist regime's designation of Palestinian civil society organizations as terrorist organizations and urged the Israeli regime to reverse it. They also demanded that the crimes committed by the occupation regime during its unjustified military attack on Gaza Strip in August 2022 be included in the ongoing investigation into the situation in Palestine. Moreover, they stressed the need to speed up the investigation, which should include crimes against humanity such as apartheid and persecution, as well as the need to issue proactive statements to prevent Israeli regime actions that could contribute to the continuation of such crimes. The groups added that all of the crimes committed in Palestine, including persecuting Palestinian organizations, should be investigated by the ICC according to Article 9 of the Rome Statute.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah.
This is a part of political divine will of the founder of Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini. Now that, with the blessed support of Allah and with the endeavor of the committed nation, the foundation of the Islamic Republic has been laid, we should bear in mind that what is important in establishing the Islamic government is Islam itself and its progressive rules. It is formidable for the great nation of Iran to ensure the implementation and protection of Islamic values in all aspects of life.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear audience. Welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. This is Zainab Musavi, and in this program, we try to have a profound reading of Imam Khomeini's precious words and speeches. Now, in this episode, what we're going to talk about is Imam Khomeini's views on ethics and spirituals. In that regard, he says Islam only values virtue and piety. Whoever is more pious and virtuous has more value before God. Well, this sentence revolves around the value of human beings. There are several definitions and requirements for value in either Islamic or general religious contexts. While some religious texts emphasize on honesty, integrity, love, and happiness as criteria for values of human beings, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh is viewing value from a different aspect. The first point about this sentence is that human's value is defined in his or her relation to God. In fact, such type of spiritual value is of utmost importance in human's life, and it is the most comprehensive aspect of viewing value. Another lesson one could take from this sentence is that if somebody wants to build his or her soul, two of the best accommodations for that purpose are virtue, or what we call in Arabic birr, and piety or taqwa. When we look at the teachings of Islam and the acts of worship, we understand that in most cases, Islam guides people towards the state of taqwa. Taqwa incorporates consciousness and fear of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, as well as piety. Okay, let's have a short break and we'll be back in no time. Welcome back, dear audience. You are listening to Spring of the Truth. We were talking about the concept of value in human beings, and we said that piety and virtue are important factors in that regard. Virtue in Islam refers to doing good deeds which might be in favor of others. The Islamic moral virtues are wisdom, courage, charity, and justice. A person who has developed the four faculties within himself or herself isn't praiseworthy unless the possession of these virtues benefit other people as well. In other words, purely internal and private virtues do not have much value, and their possessors do not deserve praise. We can see that Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh sees human value in both internal and outside aspects of it.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, believing in prophets and imams. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of believing in prophets and imams in the Islamic lifestyle. When we say the prophets and imams, obviously we are talking about infallible personalities. When we say that it is necessary to believe in the nabuwwah, in the prophethood, and the imam and the leadership of the infallible people, the infallible successors of the prophet, it is necessary to believe that all of them are infallible. Why? Because if they are fallible and they can do mistakes, maybe in a hidden form, maybe apparently, then obviously on the day of judgment, Allah cannot question us. Why? Because the ones who He sent for us for the guidance, if they were fallible, and we are fallible, so there's no difference between us. If they can commit sin in a hidden form, not apparently, for example, some people do believe that the prophets can perform sin or like they perform, they're fallible when they, in hidden form, then obviously when we are performing a sin in a hidden form, it's not apparent, people cannot see what we are doing, then obviously Allah cannot judge us because the one who was my role model, he was doing that. So I was following his footsteps so I can give this answer. Therefore, it is necessary that the prophets should be infallible. It is necessary that the imams should be infallible. So they do not commit sin even when they are alone, when they are in public, in hidden form. Apparently, they never commit a sin. And that's why Allah made them the role model so that tomorrow if he questions us that why you have performed this whereas the one I have sent to you was infallible and he never committed sin. You were obliged to follow this person while you committed sin. And there I am answerable to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of following the prophets and the imams in the Islamic lifestyle. So we said it is necessary to have this belief that we need to follow them. We need to believe in the nabuwwah. We need to believe in imamat. Why? Because these are infallible personalities. And the infallible personalities can tell us where to go, which path to follow. Obviously, if we want to get the perfection can be obtained by following the infallible personalities, the ones who never committed sin, who has gone through this path, who has done this journey of perfection, maybe in a day, maybe in seconds. Maybe Allah knows in His knowledge that they have done this traveling, this journey, they have this journey. So the one who has done the journey, they know how to go towards the perfection. Because if we follow a fallible person and he's experimenting how to go towards the perfection, maybe he achieves some perfection in his life, and there after that he commits some sins, and after that he come back like his status is taken from him, or he loses some perfection, then we cannot follow such a person because he himself is experimenting that to reach to the perfection. Whereas when there is an infallible person who is the leader, who is the role model, because he has done the journey, he's gone through the journey, he reached to the perfection, he knows how to go there, then we need to follow him and he guides us. And therefore it is necessary to believe in the prophethood. It is necessary to believe in the imamate after the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and to follow these personalities so that we can reach to the perfection and we can achieve the goal of having an Islamic lifestyle, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
Moscow charged Kiev's Western backers with ignoring its warnings that NATO's informal expansion into Ukraine was crossing Russia's red line. Officials in Moscow said Ukraine is being used for a proxy war against Russia by the United States and its allies, and they want to destroy Russia with illegal sanctions. But Russia will confront them and is trying to increase its economic interactions with countries of East Asia and the subcontinent, such as China and India, to deal with the economic sanctions. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Sputnik News Agency has covered the story. Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Alexander Grushko said on Friday, 16th of December, imposing new sanctions on Moscow is a choice of the European Union, but these measures undermine the interests of the member states of the European Union as well. The Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Alexander Grushko said, European Union states are abandoning market principles in energy, finance, and in many other areas. This is their choice. But this choice, when implemented in concrete actions, undermines international economic relations in the form in which they have been formed in recent years and undermines the economic interests of these countries. The Russian diplomat said it is impossible not to see that all these sanctions benefit the United States, adding that Russia will develop measures to ensure its economic interests. On Thursday, 15th of December, the European Union agreed in principle on the 9th package of sanctions against Russia. The final technical procedure for the execution of these sanctions package completed on Friday, 16th of December, after which the sanctions must be published in the EU official journal. After that, they will come into force. After Moscow launched its special operation in Ukraine last February, the US, the European Union, and Britain imposed economic restrictions against Russia. In October of this year, the EU adopted its 8th package of sanctions against Moscow, which included a legislative basis for setting a price cap for maritime shipments of Russian oil to third countries. In December, the European Union also joined the G7 decision to set a price cap on Russian oil at $60 per barrel. The cap will be reviewed every 2 months to remain at 5% below the International Energy Agency benchmark. However, Moscow refused to accept the price limit, saying that Russian oil would only be sold to countries on a market basis. So far, the sanctions have resulted in a major fuel crisis in Europe, record high inflation, and skyrocketing energy prices. The English website of Al-Sharq Al-Owsat newspaper has also covered the same story. Russia says the European Union's latest round of sanctions against Moscow will just exacerbate economic woes within the European bloc. The latest measures, which blacklist nearly 200 more people and bar investment in Russia's mining industry, are part of the ninth wave of sanctions imposed on Russia since President Vladimir Putin ordered the launch of a special operation in Ukraine on 24th of February this year. Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova reacted to the measures on Saturday, 17th of December. Zakharova said the current package will have the same effect as all the previous ones, exacerbation of socio-economic problems in the European Union itself. Maria Zakharova also called on the European Union to cancel all restrictions that are having a direct or indirect impact on Russian exports of grains and fertilizers. Russian President Vladimir Putin said recently Kremlin would expand trade cooperation with new partners, including by sharply ramping up gas exports to China. Back in November, the Chinese President Xi Jinping reassured he is willing to build a closer partnership with Russia in the energy sector. Citing an Indian oil ministry source, the Reuters news agency reported recently that New Delhi will continue buying Russian oil and even look for term contracts as sanctions allow purchases, provided that Western services are not used. China and India are currently the largest buyers of Russian crude oil. German newspaper Bild am Sonntag has also covered the same story. The German newspaper Bild am Sonntag reports on Saturday, 17th of December, that dozens of Russians and Belarusians have filed lawsuits at the EU Court of Justice to challenge their inclusion on the sanctions list. The Luxembourg-based court has reportedly received claims that from one company and 61 individuals from Russia and Belarus placed on the EU blacklist over their alleged support for Moscow's special operation in Ukraine. The business figures are seeking to challenge what they view as a violation of their rights and the freeze of their assets by European Union authorities. According to media reports, the plaintiffs in Luxembourg include Russian billionaire and former owner of the English football club Chelsea, Roman Abramovich, ESN Group owner Grigory Berezkin, and Gennady Timchenko, who owns Volga Group, a Russia-based company with interests in the energy sector, transportation and construction. Alpha Group co-founder Mikhail Friedman and Alisha Usmanov, the owner of Russia's largest iron ore producer, are also among those who are suing. The European Union has adopted 9 rounds of anti-Russia sanctions since last February, when Moscow launched its special operation in Ukraine. Aside from business people, the penalties include measures against Russian journalists and Russian companies. On Friday, 16th of December, the European Union blacklisted 141 Russian individuals and 49 legal entities, including ministers, governors, judges, parliament members, singers and presenters, as well as 5 political parties. The latest measures also deprived 4 more Russian media outlets of their broadcasting licenses in the European Union, introduced a number of export bans and extended restrictions on 3 more Russian banks. Export restrictions were extended to 168 additional Russian entities closely linked to the Russian military-industrial complex, bringing the total number of sanctioned companies to 410. Meanwhile, European leaders approved an 18 billion euro macro financial assistance package for Ukraine for 2023 to ensure that Kiev can cover state deficits and keep the economy running as it continues to fight Russia. To fund the aid and loan it to Kiev at a highly concessional rate, the European Union will raise common debt, a proposal that initially met resistance from Hungary. but Budapest lifted its veto recently after EU nations agreed to allow the sum of the EU funds it has frozen under the new law mechanism from 7.5 billion euros to 6.3 billion euros. A Polish veto over the introduction of a minimum global corporate tax also threatened the adoption of the assistance package on Thursday, 15th of December. But Warsaw, a staunch supporter of Ukraine, also lifted its objection. Russia launched a special operation in Ukraine last February following Kiev's failure to implement the terms of the Minsk agreement and Moscow's recognition of the breakaway regions of Donetsk and Luhansk. At the time, Russian President Vladimir Putin said one of the goals of his special operation was to denazify Ukraine. Since the outbreak of war, the United States and its European allies have imposed an array of sanctions on Russia while supplying the large cache of advanced weaponry to Ukraine, despite warnings from Moscow.
Start. Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear brothers and sisters from all around the world, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. I am Vita Treseris from Youth Station. We are Youth Generation at your service and we're going to share our point of views with you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم This is Brother Muhammad coming to you from the same station.
السلام عليكم brother.
وعليكم السلام Nice to have you, Miss Vita, together.
Yeah, for me too. So today we're going to talk about something really controversial. You know, I don't know whether you've experienced this kind of thought gap between your old, new version and your old version. For example, there are times that you post something on social media about your thoughts, feelings, whatever, and after a long time or even a short time, you came back and you see whatever you wrote there and you're like, who is this?
Oh, it is not me. Oh, yeah.
And this feeling of, you know, large gap between your thoughts and feelings when you posted them on social media and what you are now is somehow bothering. I wanted to ask your own experience on this kind of actually topic.
When you talked about this, I remember this saying, this very famous saying that you are the master of your word before you've uttered it.
Yeah.
Once you've said it, you're no longer the master of it. And that is actually very true when it comes to social media. It's even more true than ever. Reason being that we, in this modern era, we're kind of enslaved by this notion that social media, we are much more comfortable in. So we say whatever we like. We try to talk ourselves out in social media. And we post things that we don't dare saying it publicly. But
yeah.
We post it.
Yeah, exactly.
Though it has the same effect and consequences, but we post it and we say stuff in social media in the virtual environment. But then after we get that maturity and we understand that, oh, what have I done? That's like the damage has been done. That feeling is actually very common, not only for like, you know, youngsters, but same goes for any age, let's say. The thing is, when it comes to experience, the more experienced you are with social media, I think this you're less prone to this. But it's a problem that everyone faces.
Exactly.
It's something I have personally faced many times. I've posted, I can tell you, like at least this, I've posted a few things previously in one of the social medias a long time ago. And there were things, you know, more political.
Yeah.
And what happens is when things on politics, this is how it works, like it's uncovered, it's a mystery until it's uncovered.
Exactly.
And then when it's uncovered, this is when you realize, oh, what have I done?
Yeah,
I said
exactly.
Something wrong.
You're mistaken.
Yeah, so I think it all comes back to how mature you are with your posting stuff in your social media.
No, I think it doesn't matter how much you are mature, you know. It is always something that you don't know. It is always something that you have to seek for or something like that. And, you know, there is a problem with that, posting your thoughts and, I don't know, beliefs in social media. I have a lot of problem with that. Is the superficial knowledge that we're sharing together, you know what?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, for example, there is a bunch of people together gathering and they are talking about, I don't know, something, and you know, they are thinking, talking superficially, and that is really bothering. And if you allow me, we'll go for a break and then we're going to come back and talk about this kind of pain in the neck. So dear listeners, stay tuned. Welcome back. This is Youth Station. You are listening to us on IRB English Radio. So, your brother, we're talking about the superficial knowledge that we're sharing on social media about our thoughts and beliefs and so on. So, have you ever done such a thing without any kind of research or, I don't know, something you didn't know, but you were kind of feeling something that you are expert in that? Only a feeling, and you've posted something.
Personally speaking, I've had less encounters of those because being knowledgeable in the IT field, I know that some things are like undoable. You can't undo certain things. And I'm kind of precautious when it comes to social media generally because of the privacy issues and all the other issues that come around it. And in addition to that, I have a lot of friends that would really quickly get back to me on everything I say on social media. So I normally cater for them before I post anything. So I have this layer of precaution.
Yeah.
But even with this layer of precaution, yes, many a times we do become superficial when we kind of post things. And when I think about it, yes, like I said, politically, many a times, especially youths, us in this age that we're in right now, it's an age in which we normally want to get out there. We want to get our thoughts out there.
Yeah,
let the people know what we feel and believe without us, you know, properly researching necessarily. But that happens. It's very regretful, to be honest.
Exactly. You know, because you are just going extreme in that issue, especially political issue and something, and you think you know everything, you are expert and so on. This is a problem, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But let's go through the topic of the roots and the reasons of this behavior that we show.
Yeah.
You know, if there are thoughts and that we don't want to talk to anyone, but we post them at the same time. What is this paradoxical content? Why do we do that? You know, there were a study in Harvard University that there were main six reasons for this behavior that we show. First of all, we want to exchange information. This is so easy, you know,
mm-hmm.
because in real world, this is really difficult to, for example, find someone and tell them, okay, this is my beliefs. I want to exchange information with you.
Yeah,
and this is the
true.
First reason.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one is social support. We need social support. You know, we need somebody to tell us, okay, you're doing well, you're thinking well, you're educating, and something like that.
Just to take a point there, that social support does not necessarily come from the social media, correct?
Yeah, exactly. I do agree
so
with
it's
that.
A much more general point than mm-hmm. it being something posted.
But it's easier, you know, gained in social media, I think.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
The third one is friendship. Make friends with other people. You know, I think this goal is somehow paradoxical because when you go through this social media and post your thoughts and beliefs and you are the true self that you want to be, you know, it feels like you are somehow arrogant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it occurs to me that I acted in social media and I was in relation with some people only in virtual world and they felt like, okay, how arrogant you are. They told me.
Yeah.
And when they saw me in the real world, they were like, okay, you are kinder
than
which is, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's the big difference between the virtual and the actual
exactly.
world.
And the fourth one is recreation for entertainment, you know, because it's as a, you know, we look at it as a hobby. And the fifth one is common interest, love the topic of something that we're going through because our own interest. And the sixth one is the technical reason. But the most important one is make a friend, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if you do agree with me, we do that to make friends, but I think it came out somehow vice versa.
Yeah, that is true. You see, we look at one dimension of it. One dimension is when you yourself feel regretful and you say, oh, what have I done? I shouldn't have done that.
Yeah.
But then there is another dimension to this entire virtual information exchange game is when others kind of have a peer pressure on you. So once they realize, oh, look, you believe in that? Really? Oh, you don't believe in that? Really? You don't believe in that? So these kinds of peer pressuring or this getting to know each other is also a very important aspect that we normally have to consider. So that also affects the point you mentioned about essentially making friends. I think what happens eventually is when you kind of get out there and you express yourself, your beliefs, your feelings, and eventually what happens is you would find people around you that are very close to your own beliefs. So I have business friends, I have family, I have other friends, I have political friends, I have friends from my classes and so on. But then I essentially know from the postings that they send, I know how I interact with them.
Yeah,
like for my business friend, I don't care what their political views are, I just do my business exchange with them.
This is a beautiful story. You know, there is a beautiful story about my own experience that I want to tell you. Let's skip it, just for the break, and then we're going to come back.
Sure.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Welcome back. This is Youth Station. We're talking about something really controversial, about posting your ideas and thoughts on social media. And I wanted to tell you a story about my own experience on this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really interested in reading real blogs and, some personal real blogs about day-to-day life and something like that, especially medical student, because it's related to my own major. And once I was reading a kind of real blog from a girl, and she was anonymous without any name or any age or something.
Yeah, like half the people in the virtual world these days.
Yeah. And I was reading. It was about, 10 years ago. It was written 10 years ago. And I actually got to the end of that roadblock, and that girl actually passed away because, because of cancer or something.
Oh, my.
And, I felt like, okay, I don't know you. I don't know your name. You're anonymous, completely anonymous to me, but you are still alive in my mind.
Yeah.
Actually, this is the beauty of posting your own thoughts and beliefs in social media.
Oh, yeah, it is. When we look at the negative aspect of it, we should not forget the positive aspect.
Exactly.
Because there are always two sides of the coin. And when we consider the good things that social media has brought to us, we should also be very careful with the negative aspect. And that is with regards to one very important point within the same topic is how youths are very vulnerable to changing their beliefs just because of a post from an influencer that they find, and that influencer itself might eventually be regretful of what they posted, but the damage has been done. The youths have gone through that stage of believing in what that person has said. Now, this is, I think, very important. If we are a person or a group of persons who believe in something and we have a lot of influence in the society, I think it's there should be more layers of precaution before we post something. We should also see the consequences that happens, because it's not only regretful for ourselves as influencers, I'm talking from the influencer's perspective, but it's very, very important as we look at the audience, because they're going to be affected by the posts we make.
But there is a problem which I think is a kind of rooted problem that we cannot solve with that much easily. There are some influencers and social media that they post their feelings, thoughts, and everything, and they're like, they feel like they're a god. They feel like they're the boss, and they can tell you what to do and not to do, and they act as sure as you think that this is the most correct thing in the world.
Yeah. And you see many people following them. That's the bad thing is you see many people. They let's just take some arenas over here. You'll see so-called celebrities, right?
Yeah.
Their entire job is either to play football or to just act in movies. But look at the things that they express in social media. Oh my! How much experience do you have in that? How much knowledge do you have in that? And the unfortunate thing is many of them are sometimes affected by other social medias, not research, not education, not experience, but they're just affected by others. They're affected by the vibe, and they simply just surf on the wave that is in the social media itself.
Exactly, and this
which
vibe
really affects the youth these days. Mm-hmm. If you look at the recent incidents that are happening around the world, not only in Iran but around the world, you'll see it's because of these so-called celebrities in social medias would not necessarily feel regretted after they post, but the effect that they have in the society is actually regretful.
Yeah, exactly. And unfortunately, because most of the majority of the people who are the influence of these influencers are the youth generation, you have to understand that, okay, there is good things, there are, you know, bad things in anything, and you have to find yourself. And yeah. When you find yourself and you identify yourself in social media, then you can post your ideas, you can post your feelings, and you can go and share them and talk about them and contribute them. And I don't know, whatever with other people. And this interaction, you know, is kind of more safe and you're sure about yourself.
Us posting, that's good. But then the audience, should we accept any and everything that we see on media? Or should we should we consider a person who is a footballist or a person who is an actor or an actress as the role model for every single aspect of her life?
It's not like that. I do not, the fact that I shouldn't accept something like that from a celebrity. The fact is that it will affect me unconsciously, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's just a problem. I think that you have to control yourself.
Yeah, but if you as the audience of this celebrity, this so-called influencer, you're eventually giving yourself to a person, you're taking thoughts from a person that is not necessarily qualified to give you those thoughts. Don't you think that is true?
Yeah, it is true, actually. You know, but so just tell me only one sentence about these posting thoughts and, I don't know, feelings on social media.
I'll give you one word. Be careful.
Thank you. That was really nice. So, as dear brother tells us, we have to be careful in this kind of dangerous world. Thank you for listening to us. It was all the time that we have for today's episode. This is IRIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
About you, IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Role of Erdogan power's policies in recent bitter events in Iran is obvious. This is the part of speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on October 3, 2022, during the joint graduation ceremony for the cadets studying in the academies of the Islamic Republic of Iran's armed forces. This ceremony was held in Imam Hassan al-Mushtaba alayhi salam University of Officer and Police Training. If you look at Europe, especially France, massive riots occur every now and then on the streets of Paris. I want to ask you, has the US President or the US House of Representatives ever supported European writers? Have they ever issued a statement saying we stand with you? Is there any record of the mass media, which is affiliated with American capitalism, the US government, and their mercenaries, like some of the governments in the region, unfortunately, such as the Saudi government? Is there any record of them supporting the writers? Is there any record of them announcing that they will provide this hardware or that software for the internet and put it at the disposal of writers so that they can easily communicate with each other and carry out their plans? Is there a history of such a thing happening anywhere in the world, in any country? But it happened here, and not just once or twice. It has happened many times, over and over again. Well, how can you not see foreign hands at play? How can an attentive person not sense that there are other hands behind the scenes of these events? Other policies are at play.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Of course, they falsely pretend that they care that someone has passed away in the world. They are lying. They are not upset by this at all. In fact, they are happy. They're happy because they have a pretext for creating unrest. They lie. Here, the heads of the three powers of the state, executive, legislative, judicial, expressed their sorrow and sympathized with the grieving family. Then certain elements murder other people who are innocent and have not committed any crime. The judiciary promised to follow up on this to the end. This is what investigations are all about. It means following up on a case, saying the results, and saying if anyone was guilty of something or not. And if someone was guilty, identify them.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with the reporters.
Family members of the victims of the Itaewon tragedy and thousands of their supporters remembered those 158 mostly young people whose lives were taken in a crowd crush October 29th. Some read letters to their lost loved ones.
Last year, we made a whole bunch of snow ducks all around outside our apartment. Please come and see me in my dreams sometimes. Please come see me someday. Maybe even as my future child. I love you forever, Seon.
Although tens of thousands were gathered, police did not manage the crowds and ignored emergency calls hours before the deadly crush. Among those who perished in the tragedy, 26 of them were foreigners. 5 of those were Iranian. And like many of the young people who died that evening, they were students who visited South Korea to get more experience in the world and primarily more education to better themselves. Victims' families want the truth and those responsible brought to justice. A class action lawsuit is suing the government, which has often deflected responsibility and blamed the victims. It reminds some of the ferry sinking in 2014, in which more than 300 people died.
The law should be a law to punish wrong people, but the government is humiliating, insulting, and degrading the victims and the families of the deceased. In the end, I think this happened because the Sewol ferry accident was not properly resolved.
Tonight marked the 49th day since the tragedy, signifying the end of the mourning period, when the spirit of those dead to be reborn reaches Buddha and bliss. Frank Smith, Seoul.
It's a daybreak. Raju Yadav is piling up his stock for the delivery in the retail market. He's delighted, saying markets are picking good pace and prices in the whole markets are not fluctuating since last quarter. Earlier, I would buy limited stock, he says. But since the prices are consistent and demand is satisfactory, I have bought more stock than usual. I'm testing my luck, he says. Many Indians like Raju are optimistic as the country is picking up pace as the fast-growing major economy.
We are not strictly a very heavily exporting nation. Most of our producers actually rely on our domestic market. But exports are important for us because we do import some very critical commodities.
Experts say with COVID outbreak shaking major economies, India maintained its consistency in almost all sectors except the manufacturing and employment, which they say is like a diesel engine and needs a major boost. Many economic experts say investments are flowing smoothly in the world's second most populous nation, adding the country needs to revitalize its manufacturing sector, job creation, and address bottlenecks in power, mining, and infrastructure.
More than the economy, I would say our problem, what the manufacturing sector can boost is good jobs, you know, which all Indians will agree are lacking in India. I mean, that's why so many of us go abroad, right? Because these good jobs are lacking, we are wasting our talent. And the reason is that we have never seriously thought about how to make manufacturing grow.
India growth forecast is projected at 7% despite turbulent markets and war in Ukraine that shook markets. Based on Morgan Stanley and S&P Global, the country is projected to overtake Japan and Germany to become the third largest economy by 2030. Economic experts say trade tensions between the United States and China will also open up new opportunities for India as the companies are considering India for production capacity as a second option. Many, however, argue India needs double-digit growth, which would be vital for the second most populous nation, where a huge workforce and young professionals join the market every year, besides lifting millions out of poverty. While the coronavirus pandemic ravaged the world's economy, India managed to mitigate the impact of the outbreak, mainly by relying on its domestic market. But experts say the economic growth is expected to fall in the coming months as the country grapples with high inflation, rising unemployment, and a spike in oil prices, and also a threat of global economic recession. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Protest through Brussels on Friday was organized by Belgium's three largest unions. They claim the country's federal government and EU authorities are failing to adequately help citizens during the current escalating cost of living crisis. Many also question how the EU is able to set aside at least 20 billion euro for Ukraine in 2023.
We are all against this war because it's about imperialism, it's about money. There's more behind. It's not only about Ukraine and about Russia.
Ukraine is a key point, but our people here as well. And the money is there. People have to be taxed properly, especially the 1%.
It's important to help the Ukrainians, but what about the people here in
in Europe and in Belgium.
The EU's energy sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine have backfired. Oil, gas, diesel, petrol and electricity prices are through the roof. Inflation across the eurozone is running at 10%. However, wages are not going up.
Many people can't buy the good food. Many people can't pay for our apartment.
Landlords are taking advantage from the inflation to raise the rents.
Landlords will now have another excuse. The European Central Bank increased interest rates by a half of 1% on Thursday.
And based on the substantial upward revision to the inflation outlook, we expect to raise them further.
The national strike on Friday resulted in flight cancellations, according to Brussels Airport. There were also major disruptions to tram, bus and metro services. Union members, not just here in Belgium, but across the EU, are warning of protests throughout 2023, which will impact public services, unless their cost of living concerns are addressed. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The people providing the nation with care, asking to be looked after by the authorities. Some of the tens of thousands of UK nurses who have walked off their jobs demanding better pay and conditions. Lakshmi has worked for the NHS for 22 years.
Shortages of nurses have led to less staff, and you can't care for people if you don't have a staff to care for. So it's person safety. Mainly, and fear comes. Obviously, people are leaving profession due to unfair pays, overworked, stressed, and shortage of staff.
Hailed as heroes during the pandemic, nurses up and down the country, Save Scotland, are staging two 12-hour strikes this week and next. Their representative body, the Royal College of Nursing, says they had no choice when the government rejected calls for talks on NHS pay. The RCN says nurses are 20% worse off in real terms today than they were in 2010 due to successive below-inflation pay rewards.
Things have gotten so bad that hospitals, one in four hospitals, are having to set up food banks for nurses and for other staff. This is unprecedented. But we're not just fighting for pay, we're fighting for the survival of the NHS.
One reason for that concern is the number of staff leaving the profession. 25,000 nursing staff have quit the NHS in the past year. The government says the demand for a 19% pay rise is not affordable. The unions argue the money is there. The nurses' strike is part of a wave of industrial action sweeping the UK this year, with the strikers demanding better pay and conditions as a worsening cost of living crisis pushes more and more people into dire straits.
The unions are warning that the strikes this month could be the beginning of a longer period of action if governments refuse formal pay negotiations or if future talks do not result in satisfactory outcomes. Saeed Purizep, London.
The Saudi-led coalition has once again detained two fuel ships, preventing them from reaching the crucial western port of Hodeidah. The Yemeni Petroleum Company says the two fuel vessels were detained despite obtaining the necessary permits and being cleared from inspection in the port of Djibouti.
Preventing fuel ships from entering Yemen continues to take its toll on the country's battered economy. It has led to an increase in food prices and basic supplies and has made life harder for the Yemeni people as Saudi Arabia continues its blockade.
Rashid Al-Haddad, an economic expert, says the seizure of the fuel ships is just one of many war tactics employed by the Saudi-led coalition to put pressure on the Yemeni people.
The Saudi aggression is always exerting effort to make life difficult for all Yemenis by depriving them of fuel resources. 70% of fuel enters the country through the port of Hodeidah, which affects 22 million people. The Saudi-led coalition is using this as a war tactic, not against Ansarullah, but against the Yemeni people as a collective punishment.
Considering the expected rise in shipping prices, Dalal, a local fruit merchant, says he will be forced to raise his prices if no fuel enters the country.
This watermelon is normally sold for 1,500 Yemeni riyals when fuel is available. However, whenever they prevent fuel from entering Yemen, the price of this watermelon increases from 1,500 to 3,000 Yemeni riyals.
This blockade has caused an economic crisis. The price of wheat and fuel have increased. We don't have anything and we're not even being paid salaries. We're besieged from all aspects.